15 minutes. So she had...
Welcome to Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis here on UFO Paranormal Radio Network, also broadcast live on UPRN 105.5 New Orleans. I'm your host, Dee Andrew, and tonight my guest is Nick Redfern. My guest tonight is a prolific writer who has written books on a variety of 14 topics, including monsters, cryptozoology, UFOs, Roswell, and alien abductions. Nick often lectures in the United States as well as abroad. Nick has a new book out called The NASA Conspiracy, The Truth Behind the Moon Landing, Censored Photos, and The Face on Mars. This book was a fascinating read, and I highly recommend it. Nick has been a guest on the program before, and I'm very pleased to welcome him back as my guest this evening. Hi, Nick, and how are you tonight?
Hey, Dee, I'm doing good, thanks. Thanks for having me back on the show.
Oh, I appreciate you joining us tonight. Sure. This book is I think... some of your best work.
Oh, well, thank you.
What got you, got the idea in your head to write a book on NASA conspiracies?
Well, I think more than anything else, you know, when you sort of work as an author and you write books or magazine articles or give lectures, you know, people often come up to you and want to tell you their stories or relate information that they know from family members or friends, etc., that, you know, leads you on to a different story. And one of the things I found, sort of going through files and notes, etc., and interview tapes, about a year or two ago, when I was sort of looking around for new book ideas, was how many people had precisely done that, come to me, but who had information relative to NASA. And, you know, I think a lot of people are aware of the theories, or some of the theories surrounding the face on Mars and the issue of whether or not we went to the moon. But one of the things I found was that a lot of these additional stories that I'd got on NASA had never been seen before, and I always think, you know, that's an important factor when you're deciding to write a book, is not necessarily just what you're going to write about, but you want people who are going to spend their dollars or pounds or whatever buying it, you want to be able to give them something new to read rather than cheat them by going over old ground. And I was, you know, that's what I always look for in a book. You know, you want new information when, you know, when even I read a book. And the very fact that I did uncover a great deal of new material which hadn't been seen before, I thought, well, you know, why not put this out for people to see, and it'll bring something new to the table with respect to this whole issue of, you know, what NASA may know about UFOs and things like that.
Well, you literally cover from the beginning, I guess you could call it, of the space age, with in the introduction with the launch of Sputnik.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all the way to present day, and on into the future. How did you decide what to put in?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, a lot of people don't realize that, you know, when you write a book, very often there's one thing that the publisher binds you to, and that is the length of the book. You know, most publishers, they want to put a book out of a certain length because, you know, if it goes over a certain length, then they have to put the price up. The more pages, you know, the more cents and dollars. So I was actually strictly limited to 60,000 words. I could not exceed that. So sometimes, you know, sort of like a little insight into the world of publishing, it can be sort of difficult to know what to put in and what to leave out. So, you know, I tried to go with the best stuff and leave out the stuff where possibly there wasn't additional corroboration, or it was a friend of a friend of a friend's story. You know, I tried to just stick with those that, you know, were sort of first-hand stories, and where there was additional corroboration with files and documents and commentary from other people, etc. So, you know, those are sort of the things that you, as an author, sort of tend to go with, you know, give stuff where people can sort of get into the meat of the story immediately, and it has some substance to it.
Oh, one of my favorite conspiracies, which I think you did a good job of putting to rest, of course, was the moon landings.
Mm.
Used to drive me crazy when people would come in and say, oh, the moon landings were fake. They were all done in the soundstage.
Yeah, I mean, I call the book The NASA Conspiracies because it's a study of conspiracy theories that have been leveled at NASA in, you know, various areas, UFOs, aliens, all sorts of different things. But I call the book The NASA Conspiracies because it's a study of those conspiracy theories. But what I didn't want to do was just come across as like a wide-eyed believer and uphold all the different conspiracy theories. And I tried to examine each of them on their own merits or lack of merits. And so some of the conspiracy theories, you know, I agree with, and others I don't. And in terms of the moon landings, I definitively don't. You know, I really do believe we did go to the moon, and I think the Apollo missions did go ahead. But, you know, I will be the very first to admit that there's like a whole culture has developed, if you like, and a huge research arena and market, etc., for books suggesting we didn't go to the moon. To give you a good example of the sheer scale of which, you know, the theory that we didn't go to the moon is believed, back in 1999, a Gallup poll was initiated, a very ambitious Gallup poll all across the country, just the United States. And when the results came through, they estimated that approximately the percentage of people, or the number of people, I should say, within the United States alone that did not believe we went to the moon, that it was all hoaxed, was no less than 18 million Americans. Now, as I said, the poll was just in the U.S. You know, had it been done in every country across the world, we could be talking 50, 60 million people, you know, not believing we went to the moon at all. And I think one of the reasons why people believe that is simply because a lot of people have a great deal of cynicism about anything that comes out of the mouth of governments, and particularly even more so today. You know, people get very jaded about things they hear that are then contradicted. And so I think that in itself is one of the reasons. I think one of the other reasons is a lack of understanding, again, through no fault of people's, you know, own minds, but it's a lack of understanding of the science and technology involved and how misinterpretation has led to some of these theories. For example, one of the big issues that's been put forward with respect to the moon landings is that on one of the missions, which where the footage is now available, and you can even, you know, see it on YouTube, etc., where the astronauts are actually planting the American flag on the moon, it seems to shudder and shake as they're planting it on this large pole. Now, of course, the moon itself is a vacuum. It has no atmosphere. And in a vacuum, there's no air, there's no wind, there's nothing at all. So in other words, if the flag moves, then it would have to be through a gust of wind. So people say, well, you know, if there's a gust of wind, that proves it wasn't actually filmed on the moon. It must have been done out in the desert at, like, Area 51 or somewhere like that. But the important thing to note is that the footage that's been shown very often has been heavily edited to where we only see the footage where the astronauts are planting it. But if you look at the original entire raw footage where the flag's actually in view for about 29 minutes or just under 30 minutes, the flag actually only moves when the astronauts are handling it. For the other 27, 28 minutes that it's in view, it does not even shudder, move, even shake, even slightly. So I think that's an important factor that, you know, people's ideas have been sort of shaped by what essentially is misleading, well, it's not misleading footage, it's just people haven't seen the whole footage, you know, and it can create this image in people's minds when they see it moving and waving when the astronauts are holding it. One of the other areas, which I think is a very important one, is the substantial amount of moon rock that the astronauts brought back with them to the Earth, which has been, here's the important thing, it's actually been independently analyzed outside of NASA by agencies that have no vested interest, you know, in upholding the theory that NASA went to the moon or didn't. And, you know, it's clearly not terrestrial rock. And I think one of the more important things is that, you know, although the moon landings were to a degree a scientific-based mission or scientific-based missions and projects, a great deal of it was about one-upmanship against the Soviet Union, because the Soviets had put the first satellite into space, the Sputnik, in 1957. They launched the first dog into space, and they even launched the first man into space, Yuri Gagarin. So the only way to sort of trump the Russians was to put people on the moon. So in other words, had the Russians, who we know were deeply monitoring the Apollo missions, had they even the slightest inkling that the missions had been faked, I don't see any reason why they wouldn't have said so, because it would have been such a crushing thing to the U.S. space program and U.S. morale that possibly even the government would have come tumbling down, you know, like a Watergate saga. But the fact that the Russians didn't say anything leads me to believe that they knew that the missions were real, and they probably were jealous that they got beaten. But had they known anything to suggest otherwise, you know, I think they would have said so, and the whole house of cards would have come tumbling down on him.
Personally, I think what started the whole moon landing was a fake thing was the movie Capricorn 1.
Mm.
You know?
Yeah. Well, that certainly had a big bearing on it. I mean, the theory was sort of floating around before. A man named Bill Kaysing wrote a self-published booklet about it in 74 about why he didn't think it was feasible. But you're quite right. When Capricorn 1 came out in 1978, which was basically about the first manned mission to the Mars, but the scenario was basically the same, that there was a problem with the craft and NASA had gone too far ahead in the mission and planning it, so it had to be faked. And, you know, it's an interesting film, and it's a thought-provoking theory. But I think one of the bigger problems is that from when the Apollo missions began, or when the project was initiated, to when it was finished in 1972, what happened was that there was more than 400,000 people worked on that program. And that being the case, I think, it's implausible, given human nature, that even a handful of that 400,000 people wouldn't have said, hey, I was a second cameraman, you know, or I helped on build the soundstage or whatever. That has never happened. There is not, although a lot of the books have been written analysing the film footage and authors have suggested why they think it was faked, a lot of people don't realise nobody's actually come forward from NASA to say something along the lines of, you know, I was that second cameraman or whatever. That just hasn't happened. And I think for not one or two people out of more than 400,000 to do that, to me, that's just not possible, I don't think. We would have had some leaks, or somebody would have come forward, you know, shouting at the top of their voice, I think.
Yeah, I agree on that. You know, I mean, something like that. Well, it's like the alien autopsy,
you
know, footage. Somebody finally came forward and said, okay, I created the dummy, and another person came out, oh, well, I created the set.
Yeah. When it's a big conspiracy, either you see one of two things. It never seems to exist in limbo. You either get people come forward to confirm it or can add something to the conspiracy, or you have people come forward who can show why it was a hoax. It never seems to remain in like a limbo. And, you know, I think that's an important factor, is that we do have credible data now to say we did go to the moon, like the moon rocks and things like that, you know. So it's not in a he said, she said scenario of just not going anywhere. The problem is it's whether or not people accept and believe the data that demonstrates that we did go. I mean, I think also what's very convincing for me is that in July 2009, NASA's Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter spacecraft actually photographed, as it orbited the moon, the area where the landings occurred. And you can actually see evidence of, you know, structures at the site and even tracks where, for example, the lunar rover moved across the surface. The problem, of course, is, you know, this should lay it to rest, but one of the big issues is that a lot of conspiracy theorists say that, well, the photographs originated with NASA, so how can we prove, you know, they weren't retouched? So it's like a circular argument. And I truly believe that, although I do think we went, I truly believe that this matter won't be resolved to everybody's satisfaction until an independent country goes back to the moon and possibly even lands, you know, within half a mile of where the Apollo landings occurred, and then just, you know, takes a little vehicle over there and literally photographs and films the area. I think that will be the only way it's going to be resolved to everybody's satisfaction.
Oh, I agree. I agree. You know, there's just always going to be somebody or quite a few somebodies out there who still think that he didn't go.
It may be we'll never resolve it, because even if, you know, an independent nation with no ties to NASA photographs it, they may well say, well, NASA's paid them off. And then it'll start another argument.
Another section that I'm going to go by my favorite sections in here of the book, and I love the way you this chapter's name, Mac Tooney Faces the Martians. I love that.
Well, that's, you know, this chapter deals with, I guess, the other sort of most well-known controversy or cover-up or, you know, issue relative to NASA and conspiracies, and that's the so-called Face on Mars. I'm sure most of you listeners will have heard of the Face on Mars. It's this huge face-like structure that stares upwards from the surface of Mars in an area of the planet called Cydonia. Cydonia is an area of Mars located about 10 degrees north of the Martian equator. And this face-like formation was first photographed in July 1976, actually on July the 25th, by NASA's Viking 1 space probe, which was on a mission to Mars, basically, to photograph it and film it. And NASA today, publicly, at least, doesn't avoid talking about the face on Mars at all. You know, it's not their favorite topic. But if they're questioned, they'll say, well, yeah, it does look like a face. But their public view, now some people suggest they have a more controversial private view, but their public view, the stance they take, if asked, is, well, it's kind of like people seeing faces in clouds. Their view is that, you know, if you look closely and hard enough, when shadows and lights are in the right direction and the sun's casting down on certain rock formations that are different angles, etc., it looks like a face. And at other times it doesn't. That's NASA's official perspective on the face on Mars. And of course, you know, on the other hand, you have this huge research community which has deeply, deeply studied and analyzed the photographs that NASA has declassified into the public domain that have been brought back from now several missions to Mars, where it's been photographed from the 70s onwards, pretty much up to the present day in varying degrees. Of course, the big question is, what does it show? And, you know, from my perspective, I always feel that when we're dealing with something like this, of course, when most of us, you know, we have no way to go to Mars, we can't go and look at it and, you know, stamp on it and measure it, etc., you know, we're reliant on the strong research and analysis that's been done by the Face on Mars community. And having done that, I've come away massively impressed to the extent where there's very little doubt, if indeed any doubts in my mind, that the face really is an artificial structure. Now, of course, you know, that's a highly controversial statement to make. However, if you look at the body of evidence that has been collected by, you know, literally dozens of researchers now, you know, I think it is extremely impressive. A lot of the researchers do believe that the face itself is carved out of a natural structure, something like a huge natural mesa, you know, that we find in like Nevada or Arizona or New Mexico or whatever, but that what we're seeing is some sort of mega-scale engineering that transformed a natural mesa into like a carved face staring upwards. Now, of course, there are several big questions. Well, who carved it? When was it carved? And what was the purpose? Now, many of the people in the research field that have looked into the face on Mars, you know, they look at it having been weathered and Mars's atmosphere, etc., and the nature of the planet today. And, you know, suggestions have been made that it could have been constructed 100,000 years ago, 250,000 years, 500,000 years, you know, when most people in the field do not believe we're talking about something constructed or carved, say, 5,000 years ago, 10,000 years ago. You know, we're talking about something in Mars's very, very ancient past. Now, if indeed the face on Mars is a carved structure, then clearly the atmosphere and the nature of the planet must have been very, very different 250,000 years ago than it is today. Now, Mars isn't a dead world. You know, it has an atmosphere, although it's certainly not an atmosphere we can breathe. And it has substantial amounts of frozen water at its ice caps, massive amounts, actually, at the North and South Pole. And on some of the photographs that NASA has released, you even see evidence of what looks like running water in certain places, and even massive amounts of vegetation. If you type in, for example, into Google, banyan tree, B-A-N-Y-A-N, plus Mars, you'll see some very strange-looking photographs of what almost look like massive forest land, but obviously trees and bushes and shrubs that don't look like the sort of ones we see on Earth, but that is what they look like. So I don't dispute or doubt that Mars may not be the dead world that many people believe it to be. However, clearly if there was an advanced civilization that built the face, you know, half a million years ago, the planet would have been very different to now. You know, it would have had countries, oceans, you know, massive vegetation, cities of some sort even. And we do see, even today on Mars, evidence of very large ancient shorelines where, you know, the water now just doesn't exist anymore. So clearly something disastrous on a planet-wide scale must have happened to Mars in its ancient past. You know, whether people have speculated like a strike of a comet or some massive body passing by Mars that, you know, affected its gravitational pull or turned it on its axis and, you know, the atmosphere and the planet began to degrade massively to the point where life may have been almost totally wiped out. And, of course, you know, if you have cities, if you have buildings, you know, you have, you know, just constructions, you know, whether computers, bookcases, whatever, they're not going to last the test of time if the atmosphere is gone and there's nothing left. What we would likely see left are static, rigid formations like mesas. And if one of these has been carved, then that's possibly why the faces have survived. What's more intriguing is that on some of the photographs that NASA has sent back and released, and this is the weird thing, that actually released these pictures even, not far from the face, you can see what look eerily like Egyptian pyramids. You know, they're literally like four or five sided pyramids. And, you know, NASA's view of these is that these are natural rocks that are just weathered, you know, by the wind. But if you look at them, you know, they truly don't look like weathering. They look like carved, symmetrical, pyramid-like formations. And, of course, you know, people have drawn parallels between the face and the Egyptian Sphinx. Then when you find there are pyramid-like structures near the face, and we have pyramids in Egypt right next door to the Sphinx, this has led a number of people to speculate on the notion that possibly if there was an indigenous intelligent civilization on Mars countless thousands and tens of thousands of years ago, and they had advance notice that some big disaster was coming, maybe sort of like a last-ditch attempt was made to send like an armada of craft from their planet to our planet, so some sort of continuation of their species would happen. And maybe, you know, maybe they landed in the Middle East, you know, maybe they came down by Egypt, possibly even influenced some of our early cultures. And it is a fact that the Egyptians, you know, they kind of went from being primitive hunter-gatherers to having the ability to build highly advanced structures like the pyramids pretty much overnight. You know, the big question is, were they helped? You know, did somebody come down, make their home here, and kind of upgraded the natives, if you like, and taught them a few things, or a lot of things, and even about culture and their architecture, and we kind of copied them or were helped. So in other words, you know, people speculated that if the face is real and NASA knows more about it and is hiding the truth, one of the reasons could be not just because it demonstrates that there might have been advanced life on Mars once, but also that the face on Mars could somehow be intimately tied in with our own history, something we've forgotten or lost, and that could radically overturn our world views. And maybe there are people in government that don't want that. You know, they don't want us, you know, looking at things from a different perspective. They want it all black and white, and the status quo, if you like, not being challenged.
I have a question here from a virtual auditorium, and Vidal asks, what do you think about Richard Hoagland's Mars theory?
Well, yeah, I mean, Richard's got some very interesting theories. I mean, one of them relates directly to the face on Mars. Richard has done some very intriguing research showing that the existence of the face on Mars might have been known long before NASA actually announced, you know, the discovery of the face, if you like, by these photographs in 76. For example, Richard noted that Jack Kirby who was a famous comic book artist. He drew all the artwork for like early comic books like the Hulk and the Fantastic Four and, you know, like the early superhero comics, that sort of thing, for Marvel Comics. And in the late 1950s, he actually wrote and did the artwork for a comic titled The Face on Mars. And it is literally based around this huge carved face on the face of Mars that a that a fleet of U.S. astronauts fly to Mars, and they find it. And, yeah, they said not only does it look like The Face on Mars, but the comic was actually called The Face on Mars. And what's interesting about Jack Kirby is he actually had ties to the official world, to even to the CIA, which, you know, sends things down even more of a strange path. You might wonder why on earth would comic book artists have ties to the CIA. Well, in the latter 1970s, early 80s, when you might remember there was the whole thing going on in Iran, where a number of U.S. people at the embassy in Iran had been taken prisoner in Tehran by the Iranian government and or rebels. And, you know, there was plans on the part of the Carter administration to try and get the American hostages out of the embassy and back to the United States. And one of the plans that was put in place was to try and smuggle some of the employees out under cover of a cover story that they were actually part of a U.S. film company making a science fiction movie in Iran. And, you know, the plan was they'd have fake cover stories, fake passports, and they would smuggle them out the embassy, take them to Tehran airport and say, you know, we've just been in Tehran making a movie, and here's all the evidence, here's the footage, you know, here's the artwork for the movie, and et cetera, et cetera. And it so turns out that the artwork for this CIA's planned project was actually done by Jack Kirby. So, in other words, and this isn't his only tie to the official world as well, but we see several other issues also. So, in other words, you know, these are important points that Richard has made, that there seems to be additional data in the hands of the government and possibly NASA as well, that pushes its knowledge of the face on Mars and artificial structures and the potential for life far beyond not just the 70s when the pictures were taken, but possibly even before NASA was even formed, you know, which opens all sorts of questions about how would they have found this information out. You know, has there been some sort of secret space program, you know, that we don't know about? Has somebody even traveled to Mars and actually, you know, done far more research than we even know about, possibly?
Hard telling. I was going to move on to this one a little later, but I'll do it this time. Because we've got a question that kind of goes with where I was going with.
Mm-hmm.
This is from my husband, David. And he says, the rumored story about one of the astronauts on the moon telling NASA they are on the edge of the crater and they are huge. Do you know that story? And wonder if you think it's just rumor or if it's true.
Well, you know, I mean, it's an interesting story, that the little point that David brings up. You know, that there have been long-standing rumors that, you know, when the Apollo astronauts went to the moon, walked around the moon, that although the missions went ahead in the way that NASA said they did, which I do believe, one of the kind of alternative or sort of spin-off angles from the idea that we didn't go is that, yes, the astronauts went, but we haven't seen all the footage or the data and everything they collected when they went. You know, we've seen like edited versions. And this comes into play with this issue of some of the astronauts supposedly claiming to NASA and saying secretly that, you know, they saw UFOs on the edge of the craters, almost as if these things were watching them. Now, it's a very interesting story. It's been repeated, etc., and it's been attributed to certain astronauts directly. The problem is, of course, that, you know, none of the astronauts have vindicated their story. You know, some of them have said no comments. Some of them have flat out said, no, these stories are just lies. You know, they're not distortions or friend of a friend stories. They are lies. So, in other words, many of the astronauts have acted quite hostile, in a hostile fashion to this, you know, these stories, and saying there's nothing to them. Other researchers, you know, have said that, well, no, I know these stories are true. So in other words, it's one of those unfortunate situations where one person says something and somebody categorically denies it, and somebody categorically denies that. And unfortunately, that is where we're at. You know, we are at a stalemate. It literally has gone no further with either side, you know, demonstrating anything really other than a point of view and, you know, and the story that, well, this is the story. And the astronauts have said, well, prove it, you know, and no proof has been forthcoming. So that's kind of where things are at. It's just literally not gone further than a, I think this, no, I think that.
I'm kind of on the fence myself on what I would say, true or not.
Yeah. I mean, what I would say, one of the things that's been put forward as a valid, well, not just a valid, but as a relevant point to this whole issue of whether or not UFOs were on the moon, is why after the moon landings, which finished in 72, why we never went back. You know, because if you look at the original, for example, the newspapers at the time, some of the things that were coming out of the mouth of NASA, you know, they were saying, well, we're going to have a certain number of Apollo missions, and then after Apollo, you know, hopefully in the near future, we'll have another program where we'll go back, but this time we'll set up like a kind of like a very small, to start with, equivalent of like a North Pole or South Pole outpost where personnel, you know, can live. And it'll be, yeah, it'll be pretty rudimentary to start with, but over time we can send shuttle missions up and expand on it, make it bigger, and then have like an enclosed life support system, and people can work there for, you know, however long at a time, and shuttle them back and forth and replace them with other people, etc. But that never happened. You know, it was almost like we made a quick hop, skip and a jump to the moon on a number of flights, you know, half a dozen flights, and then came back again, and it was all over. You know, and all we've really had since is Skylab and the space shuttle. And not to denigrate those, you know, the space shuttle is an important craft because it was the very first one NASA ever built that was recyclable. You know, everything else goes up and comes back down, and that's it. It could not be used again. Can't be used ever, but the space shuttle was very different. So not to take away the importance of the shuttle, however, it is weird that all these grander plans for a moon base, you know, permanent mission, extra manned missions, it never went ahead. And that has led to speculation on some people's part that we were almost like warned off. You know, somebody made it clear to us that the moon was already their territory. You know, I don't think that's a highly intriguing theory.
Oh, I agree too. You know, that's the one that I've heard the most was that we went there and yeah, they watched us the first couple of times and then, you know, the next few times we were there, they started getting okay. You know, this is enough. You're invading our space type attitude, and told us not to come back.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's one of these things where if you look at the UFO presence on Earth, you know, we get massive amounts of UFO sightings and encounters. You know, I mean, people often talk about, well, how would, you know, these UFOs get from one place to the other? You know, traveling, linear travel, point A to point B, even at the speed of light, would take, you know, literally a tremendous number of years. The other theory, people talk about traveling via wormholes, where you distort space and time to, you know, travel tremendous distances in a very short period. The other theory, which I think is quite an interesting one, is they're not traveling vast distances. Maybe they actually have bases in our solar system. And, you know, possibly, who knows, on the moon or under the surface of the moon or under the surface of Mars. You know, it would make far more sense to have, like, staging posts in our own solar system than it would be to travel from some vast star system, you know, on the edge of the galaxy to here and then home again. You know, to me, it would make more sense to almost like have the equivalent of like the London Underground or the New York subway system. In simple terms, you know, where you would have stop-off points to different places, if you like.
Oh, well, gosh, even Frank Edwards, you know, was in a briefing on a future space program. Mm-hmm. You know, what would be the steps we would take if we, you know, in the future came across an inhabited planet? You know, what would we do?
Yeah.
And part of it was, well, if they've got a moon, you know, build a base there and observe them from there.
Yeah. And the other interesting thing, of course, is that, you know, when the moon orbits the Earth, it always keeps one face towards the Earth. That's why we have the far side of the moon, or as some people call it, the dark side of the moon. You know, it's not like, you know, a lot of people think in the same way that the Earth rotates around the Sun, the Moon doesn't actually rotate around the Earth. It turns around the Earth, but it's not rotating on its axis. So we always see the same face. That's why, you know, it has this dark side. And, you know, there have been rumors about, well, the dark side would be the ideal place for, you know, an alien race to work, if you like, or to inhabit, or, you know, semi-inhabit, if you like.
Agreed. Josh, we got some more. I got another question here from our virtual auditorium. This is from Skymon. And Skymon asks, "What do you think of the new movie Apollo 18? And also, did you enjoy the truth event you spoke out in Washington State?"
Oh yeah. Well, the truth event. I don't know if the person asking the question was there. The truth event. I did enjoy it. It was a conference I spoke at last month at a place called Port Townsend, I think it was. I hope there's nobody from there listening. I've forgotten the name of the town, but anyway, it was about a two-hour drive out of Seattle, and it was a conference, a first-time conference by the organizer, and you know, it was a good one because of good variation of speakers, and James Clark and Peter Davenport and myself, and I spoke about UFOs, and it was a good conference, and you know, we got a lot of feedback and questions from the audience. And I always think that's always a good sign when, you know, you get interaction with the audiences. You know, I'm not one of these speakers who, and there are unfortunately some of them, go to a conference and then they vanish off stage and you don't see them again. You know, I like to interact with the audience and hang out afterwards, and you know, I think that's that was a good sign of that conference. A lot of questions were asked, you know, a lot of thought-provoking issues brought up, so I enjoyed that. And the Apollo 18, you know, I don't even know if it's out. I certainly haven't seen it, but you know, again, it deals with sort of, you know, secret issues relative to space program and things like that. And I think what all these sort of films do when they have a basis in historical reality, even if, you know, it's done in a fictional format, is that it gets people thinking. And more importantly, you know, if there's truth to these scenarios and somebody knows about them, I think it often encourages them to come forward. And I think these are all important factors, you know, that kind of take things a bit further. You know, it's sort of somebody starts speaking about something because a new movie's out that may have a basis in reality. It brings other people forward because they feel more comfortable about speaking because somebody else is. And then it starts a spiral. So, you know, I always kind of look forward with a bit of intrigue when a new film comes out that sort of has this basis in fact. And, you know, you wonder if someone or how many people are going to come forward to sort of vindicate the story, if you like.
Oh, sure. All these stories, all the ones that are coming out, there's all this other, it just...
Yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah, I mean, it's like that Battle for L.A. film, you know, although it's set today, you know, it's sort of very loosely based on the sort of Battle for Los Angeles in the early years of the Second World War, early 1940s, when there was sort of this wave late one night, objects flying over downtown L.A., and there was this, you know, the guns and bullets, you know, were being fired up in the air to try and hit whatever this object or objects were. And, you know, actually Steven Spielberg, of all people, who did Close Encounters, he actually did a film based on this called 1941, which is a comedy film. But the battle, this new one, the Battle for LA, is sort of based on that original wartime mysterious event when this strange craft went flying over LA, and you know, there was the military was trying to shoot them down out the sky.
Yeah, I actually saw that movie. I haven't seen the Apollo 18 one yet, but
no.
I saw the Battle Los Angeles.
Was it any good? I haven't seen it yet.
Actually, you know, if you're into a good bang bang shoot 'em up, you know, type movie and explosions and you know, the heroes and all that.
Kind of like Independence Day, that sort of thing.
Actually, it reminded me more of Black Hawk Down.
Oh, okay. Uh-huh. Oh, yeah, I know. Mm-hmm.
You know, the same kind
gung-ho,
go get 'em, boys type movie. You know, I really hate getting off on talking about movies, but there are so many ET-related films. coming out this summer. Mm-hmm. Just last weekend, my husband and I went to see the movie Paul.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which I loved it. It was mm-hmm. hilarious.
Yeah, I haven't seen that one yet, but that's got a good write-up.
Yeah. However, it's not one you want to take your kids to.
No, I realize that now.
Okay, it's adult language.
Uh-huh.
You know, that's the only thing that would keep me from taking my granddaughter to go see it, is the adult language.
Yeah.
But other than that, you know, it was a pretty funny movie.
Yeah, I think, you know, and I think there's something, you know, people often get, oh, we shouldn't make fun of this subject. But I think, you know, there's nothing wrong with having a, you know, a fun, light approach to it as well. You know, there's, when you realize it's fiction, it's not, you know, it's not denigrating the subject. It's just somebody's making an entertaining UFO-themed film. You know, I don't see there's anything wrong with that. I think, you know, it's, and actually, ironically, even if it's done in a fun format, it still gets people thinking about the issues sort of relative to alien life and UFOs.
Yes. Yeah. Well, and you know, since we're on the subject of conspiracy theories, I'm kind of on the fence on this one too. I'm seeing more and more evidence for it, but mm-hmm. I'm still kind of on the fence. But there are people who say that there is an education program that involves all these sci-fi, space aliens and all that movie to desensitize the people from being afraid of them. Do you think that's a possibility or just coincidence?
No, I actually do think it's a possibility. I actually wrote a book in 2008 called Science Fiction Secrets, which actually was a study, not for the most part, but for sort of three or four chapters, on the way in which the world of Hollywood has had clear ties with, like, for example, the intelligence community.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, there's absolutely no doubt. I don't think there's, like, an official project, you know, called something like Project Science Fiction within the Pentagon or whatever, you know, in simple terms. But what I do think is that at times subtle approaches have been made by the intelligence community to influential people in Hollywood, maybe without the Hollywood people realizing what's going on, but to say, you know, put out a film on this, or how about this for an idea for a movie? And when they've bitten and, you know, they say, well, yeah, this sounds good, we'll do that, then it helps, you know, kind of acclimatize people to the notion that this is all real. And I personally do, having studied all the evidence, I do believe that, you know, these approaches have been made. I think there's strong evidence that there has been sort of manipulation to a degree of Hollywood by intelligence insiders. Now, you know, whether they want to get across a positive view of the UFO subject or a hostile view or both, you know, just to get us thinking about it, is sort of debatable. But I think, you know, I mean, I'll give you an interesting example. When Independence Day was made back in 1996, the Pentagon was actually very interested in getting involved and helping with the film, because it presented the U.S. military in, like, a good light. You know, it was that the heroes are going to save the day, and, you know, the Earth's on its last legs, but we find a way to survive. And the Pentagon, even some of these files have now surfaced through the Freedom of Information Act. They've said that, you know, they were saying, well, this presents us in a good light, you know, we're the heroes of the hour defeating the aliens. And although it's a sci-fi movie, you know, it presents a positive view of the military. And that was all going fine and dandy and everything else, and the Pentagon was happy to help, until the producers and writers of the film said, well, we want to include a section on Area 51. Can you help us with that? And suddenly, you know, the blinds went down, and it was like, no.
And they said, no, you know, no, no.
Yeah, they said, you know, we're just, no, we'll help you. You know, if you want to film at our bases, you know, film military aircraft, you know, and, you know, we'll even take to the skies and you can film us, you know, and put that in the film. But don't get on the subject of Area 51. You will get no help on that at all. You know, and so that's intriguing that they were willing to help with the film and help promote it and even allow some their planes and bases to be used to get this message across. But then you hit this stumbling block. And so I think that's what we see. We're seeing the military or the government wanting to get certain facts out via films, but there are things that for even them are sort of no-go areas, if you like. At least for now, you know, maybe that'll change in the future as if we get more disclosure, if you like.
Oh, that would be so cool.
Mm.
You know,
maybe we'll all get tours of Area 51 one day. You never know.
Oh, wouldn't that be a kick in the pants?
Sort of feed the aliens behind the cages or something.
Or find, you know, be allowed into Hangar 18.
Hangar
18 at Wright Pat.
Yeah, sort of prod the alien, this cryogenically alien corpses or whatever.
and then talk to the one that's supposedly still alive at Area 51 and all that. And all the stuff they got going at Dugway Proving Grounds in Utah, you name it. Take your pick. Oh, gosh. You know, we've got about 10 minutes before we go to break. Let's see, which section can we get into now? Turn back to the table of contents. That's the easiest way for me to go, okay, let's see. Oh, Kecksburg. That was another one I wanted to come up.
Okay.
There was so many people when this object came down in Kecksburg, Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
There were quite a few people that came forward and said, hey, you know, we've seen guys in, you know, hazmat suits, I guess is what we'd call them today.
Mm-hmm.
Or I have no clue what they called them back in the 60s, with the NASA logo on them.
Yeah.
You know, with this, the Kecksburg thing. And I think, you know, that's something that I think a lot of more digging could be done on.
Yeah, I mean, Kecksburg is a very interesting story. You know, when people talk about crashed UFOs and dead aliens, things like that, everybody thinks of Roswell, 1947. That's, you know, that is without doubt the biggest case. I mean, there's probably hardly anybody in the world who doesn't have a TV or an internet connection who hasn't at least heard of Roswell. You know, it's like, what does Roswell mean? Most people will say, whether they believe it or not, or they know much about it, oh, that's that place where the flying saucer crashed back years ago. You know, everybody knows the story. A lot of people don't realize that Roswell, or that scenario of a UFO crashing and alien bodies being found and the government moving in and collecting the evidence and hiding it, there's actually been a number of very intriguing stories, very similar to Roswell. And one of them is this one, you know, that you mentioned, the Kecksburg story of 1965. Now, Kecksburg is a little town about 30 miles southeast of Pittsburgh in Pennsylvania. And in December 1965, particularly on December the 9th, something very strange happened in the woods just outside of this little town of Kecksburg. Prior to the incident itself, there were reports from a number of U.S. states and even Canada of something strange crossing the sky and being seen, almost like a fireball, if you like. But as it closed in on Pittsburgh and then finally Kecksburg, a number of people watching it said this thing seemed to slow down and even alter its trajectory, its direction, which of course, you know, had this been like a meteorite burning up in the atmosphere or a bit of space wreckage, debris, etc., you know, there's no way it would have the ability to alter its location and certainly not slow down. You know, it would either burn up in the atmosphere or it would just slam straight into the ground at the angle that it was coming in at. But this thing seemed to change, and the story was, I said, it slowed down and clearly seems to be malfunctioning, but slowed its descent enough to come down in the woods at Kecksburg. And because, you know, Kecksburg's a little town, like any story in a little town, it doesn't take long before everybody gets to know about it. And that's precisely what happened. And so over the next sort of 24 hours, you had people, you know, kids going out in the trucks or whatever at all, trying to see what was going on. You had the media out there, you know, and just regular curious people going out to see what was going on. Many people reported that the military got there even before they did, that there was a deep, heavy military cordon. There were, like, military transporter vehicles on hand. The police were blocking roads. And as you said, people in NASA hazmat suits, that sort of thing, all basically saying, you know, stay away from the woods, you know, this, it's a no-go area tonight. And, you know, as the day developed and turned into night, more people came out then because they felt they had a better chance of actually sneaking into the woods and seeing what was going on. A number of people actually did do that. You know, they might have parked the car literally like a mile away and sort of crept across the fields and then into the woods. And you have people talking about seeing what looked like about something like the size of a Volkswagen Beetle, but shaped like an acorn, some sort of object slammed into the ground, semi-buried. Other people talked about hearing very weird animalistic screams that didn't sound like any regular animal at all. Others talked about seeing this device loaded onto like a military transporter vehicle and taken out the area. Then we have people, actually one from Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, who said that he saw the Kecksburg vehicle and even its crew brought into the base, and the crew were described as being sort of small bodies with reptilian, sort of slimy, shiny skin, wet-looking skin, if you like. Now, the official viewpoint of the military, kind of like in when the NASA doesn't deny the existence of the face on Mars, the military and NASA doesn't deny something happened at Kecksburg, but their view is that it was probably a high-flying meteorite that, as it went over the horizon, people believed it came down at Kecksburg. And they say, yeah, we did send a couple of people out there to check out the area, but they found nothing and they just went back to their relevant base. Of course, this all sort of flies in the face of the stories about a heavy military presence, roadblocks, cordons stopping people getting in the woods, etc., etc. Even silencing of the local media, the radio stations, were reportedly pressure was put on them not to talk about it. Now, because even going back to the early years, you know, there were rumors about NASA being involved in some respect, people used the Freedom of Information Act to try and pursue this and try and get NASA to reveal its files. And they said, well, you know, we've looked, we've got nothing, sorry, go away. This started to change, however, in 2003 when the Sci-Fi Channel decided, you know, we're going to make an extensive show about Kecksburg, you know, kind of the next Roswell, if you like. And the Sci-Fi Channel, you know, like most TV channels, they've got a lot of funding behind them, which, unfortunately, most people in the UFO community, you know, we don't have. You know, we're sort of limited into what we can do. But the Sci-Fi Channel was a bit different, so they tracked down witnesses, you know, traveled out to the area, interviewed people from NASA, traveled all around the country following every possible lead they could find, and sort of really dug into this story. And used the Freedom of Information Act and pushed NASA to reveal files. It, you know, basically said it'll be in your best interest because we're going to make like a, you know, an extensive documentary about this. And NASA did reveal a few files, but there were no smoking guns. You know, it demonstrated that NASA did have records relative to the case, you know, that were sort of documents talking about what the media was saying about it and things like that. But fortunately, this didn't satisfy everybody, and one of the people it didn't satisfy was a UFO researcher named Leslie Keene. And Leslie, the director of investigations for the Coalition for Freedom of Information, actually did something that probably no one else had ever done before. She brought a civil action against NASA to reveal its files, and this civil action was actually signed off on March the 27th by a U.S. judge named Emmett G. Sullivan. And it essentially dealt with Leslie's concerns about contradictory statements NASA had made with respect to Kecksburg, Leslie's concerns she had with respect to whether or not NASA had actually conducted a full search for all its documents, and also what she believed to be sort of NASA attempts to prevent people from opening up this Kecksburg can of worms. Now, unfortunately, by 2009, sort of 2 years later, 2.5 years later, you know, the battle was still going on and nothing beyond, you know, cursory documents had surfaced. But Leslie was sort of pleased that it had at least gone that far, that a judge had signed off, allowed the lawsuit to go further. But, you know, the important thing is that Leslie did find evidence where there had been sort of obfuscation and there were files missing that should have existed but they couldn't conveniently be found. So, in other words, this is all important stuff validating the notion that the story is far from dead. So, in other words, you know, we have this extensive story going back to 65, plenty of eyewitnesses, people talking about the object being recovered, obfuscation on the part of NASA, and even lawsuits that proved something was being hidden. So I think, you know, the UFO community, thanks to Leslie for a great deal, can be satisfied and happy that we've gone a stage further with it at least.
Yes, because she did a lot of work with, you know, between that and the Coalition for Freedom of Information.
Yeah.
You know, I applaud her work. She did a wonderful job.
Yeah, I mean, it's not everybody that has the clout and the ability to, you know, to take NASA on in a lawsuit. You know, it's not only to take a lot of guts, but also, you know, just the legal intricacies of understanding how to go about doing this. You know, they'll probably challenge most of us. You know, I wouldn't even ever know where to start.
We've got like maybe 30 seconds or so before we go to break. You want to give them, give our listeners, you know, where they can find the book or where they can find all of your books? Because, I mean, you're a very prolific writer.
Yeah, if people go to, the best one, if people go to Nick Redfern's books, .blogspot.com, people can find all about my books there. I have a website, which is actually, the website's in the middle of being updated, unfortunately, right now. So what's on the page right now, or the page, is kind of out of date, but it's, my main website is nickredfern.com. But in about 2 weeks, that'll be fully up to date again. And people can get the books from, from Amazon and all good bookshops like Barnes & Noble and Borders, etc.
And the name of the book is NASA Conspiracy, the Truth Behind the Moon Landings, Censored Photos, and the Face on Mars. And we will be back here in 8 to 9 minutes with more Nick Redfern and talk about the book in 8 to 9 minutes. Here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network. Welcome back to Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis, here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network, also broadcast live on UPRN 105.5 New Orleans. I'm your host, Dee Andrew. Tonight we've been talking with Nick Redfern. You know, Nick, this book, NASA Conspiracies, is really good. I really enjoyed reading it. And I was very pleased to see that you did a chapter on Gary McKenna.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. The NASA hacker, which is a continuing and ongoing story, you know, and to me, you know, I just feel bad that the guy didn't have a printer so he could print this stuff out.
Yeah, the story of Gary McKinnon is sort of strange, convoluted one that's gone on literally for now almost like it has gone on for more than a decade. It actually goes back. For people who aren't aware, I'll just give you a brief summary first. Gary McKinnon's an English guy who lives in London, and he faces extradition to the US for hacking into NASA's computer systems in search of information on UFOs. A lot of people aren't aware of actually why McKinnon did this and what it was that prompted him. It wasn't just a case of him saying, oh, I'm going to go to the... You know, NASA has a number of installations around the US. It wasn't a case of him saying, I think NASA's hiding evidence and I'm going to go looking for it and I'm just going to target this place out of any other. What actually happened was that in 2001, Stephen Greer, who runs the Disclosure Project, and you know, he's put on yearly conferences, like at the, for example, at the National Press Club, where he's brought retired military and intelligence and scientific people forward to talk about their personal knowledge of UFO phenomena. And at his 2001 event, one of the people who Stephen Greer had offering testimony was a woman named Donna Hare. And Donna Hare worked for a company called Philco. And Philco was a company that NASA contracted with at the start of the 60s to provide NASA with a worldwide tracking station network for its manned Project Mercury flights. Now, many people aren't aware that, you know, NASA doesn't build and construct all the craft and the technologies that are used in their craft, you know, that they contracted out to outsider agencies and companies like McDonnell Douglas and, you know, Lockheed and people like that. And that's what they did with Philco. And Donna Hare worked for Philco, and she actually had a very sort of prestigious history with Philco as it related to the work with NASA, to the extent that she was even awarded a NASA Apollo Achievement Award. And she worked at the Johnson Space Center, which is in Houston, Texas. and she worked in Building 8 in the photo lab, the photographic laboratory, to give it its full name. And she went on record at Greer's event talking about how on one occasion she got speaking with one of the guys who worked there, who admitted to her that one of his jobs was that prior to NASA releasing its photographs into the public domain, that his job was to airbrush anomalies out of the pictures, and that included, like, one photograph he showed her, which had, like, a classic flying saucer in one of the pictures. And so, in other words, for many of the pictures, this guy said it wasn't that NASA was withholding them and not releasing them. They were releasing them, but they were carefully touching up and retouching the pictures so that anything unusual in the picture wouldn't be seen when it was declassified. And that was his job. And Donna Hare never forgot about this, and that's what she specifically spoke about at Greer's 2001 event, these censored photographs that were being held in Building 8 at the photo lab at the Houston Space Center. Now, Gary McKinnon had an interest in UFOs, and he actually had an interest in the theory that the government was hiding advanced technologies from us that could do away with the reliance upon oil, you know, where the world could be revolutionized overnight. And so McKinnon did something that, you know, I truthfully do not recommend anybody does. You know, regardless of whether or not it's brought information forward or discussion forward, you know, he did something that has got him into massive trouble, and it will get anybody into massive trouble. You know, instead of speaking to witnesses or using the Freedom of Information Act to get documents, he literally hacked his way into the computer systems at the Johnson Space Center at Houston. As I said, I don't endorse that. I don't encourage anybody to do it, because you will end up, you know, in deep trouble, possibly even in a prison cell for a long, long time. That's what McKinnon faces. But nevertheless, what he did, he hacked into the place where Donna Hare essentially spilled the beans as to what was going on there. So that's why a lot of people don't realize that. You know, he didn't just randomly target the U.S. government. It was actually and only based upon the revelations of Donna Hare, who said this is where it was going on. So McKinnon said to himself, well, that's where I'm going to hack. And that's what he did. And he said that he found two things. One was photographs of what looked like weird structured objects in space that clearly didn't resemble space satellites or the space shuttle or anything like that. They were just weird, one for a better term, UFOs. He also said he saw listings of military personnel that were under the weird heading of non-terrestrial officers. excuse me. And this has led a lot of people to wonder if, you know, non-terrestrial obviously sounds like off the planet. Officers, clearly military personnel. McKinnon wondered if this means that somewhere within the U.S. infrastructure, whether in NASA or the military, that there was some sort of secret clandestine space program that, you know, extended in beyond NASA, that maybe NASA didn't know about, you know, that the military had its own secret space missions or something like that. And, well, McKinnon broke into the files, exited the files, and, you know, it's really asking too much to think that government agencies of any nation aren't going to know if you hack into their systems. Of course they are. They'll track you, they'll backtrack to who was doing it, the server, and eventually they'll find you. And that's what happened, and McKinnon was arrested. And even to this day, you know, I mean, he still lives in London. Even to this day, you know, he has to regularly report to a police station because he's out on bail, in simplistic terms. He wasn't allowed for a long time access to a computer with a modem. You know, that was all sort of no-go areas for him. His lawyer has successfully argued for years that if a crime was perpetrated, it was perpetrated from an English computer system in London, so he should be tried in England, and if there's a sentence, it should be, you know, commuted, you know, it should be committed, and he should be, it should serve the sentence in England. On the other hand, the US government says, well, no, he hacked into US systems in the US, so he should stand trial in the US. And, you know, admittedly, from a legal perspective, it is a very grey area. You know, nobody seems to know how to handle where and when the trial should be held and whose legality it should be held, the UK or the US. And that's one of the things that's kept this sort of rumbling for years. Nobody can agree on how to handle it. There seems to be evidence that if he's brought to the US, that he may well be tried under terrorism laws, you know, which would be like a behind closed doors trial. which would probably be disastrous from his perspective. Whereas if it's in England, it will be, you know, he committed a computer crime. It'll just be something held in a regular court. So that is kind of a situation. It's almost become, I don't want to play it down, because from McKinnon's perspective, it's obviously a very stressful thing. But it has become almost like a soap opera, in the sense that, you know, the Americans will try and get him brought over, and at the last minute, his lawyer's team will find a reason, you know, for the extradition not to occur. And the British government says, well, you know, let's see some more evidence, and they give the lawyer's team 5 months or whatever to come up with the evidence, so that gives him another 5 months breathing space or whatever. But, you know, I think it'll be interesting. I mean, I don't know what the outcome will be. We can only speculate. But I think it'll be interesting if it comes to trial, you know, that if McKinnon was just somebody who randomly hacked into computer systems, it would begin and end with McKinnon. But by his own admission, as I said, a lot of people don't realize, the only reason he hacked into this specific building at one specific NASA installation was because Donna Hare blew the whistle on where this was going on. You know, so people have speculated, well, will his defense team bring her to stand, you know, to offer testimony about what she saw? And if that does happen, that could open up a huge can of worms that the US government might not want to have to deal with. You know, that's the ironic thing, is that prosecuting the man may actually bring more and more information forward about what he actually found. And I don't think anybody involved in this whole prosecution saga wants that. You know, they want him prosecuted, they want a successful prosecution, and they want him behind jail cells for, you know, decades, you know. But, as I said, if he'd done just everything out of the blue on his own initiative, that could be the outcome. The fact that somebody who was contracted to NASA blew the whistle on where to find this information, you know, that really does open it up to a whole different factor, if you like.
Well, that, and I always wondered, you know, if they did extradite him here, mm-hmm, to the United States and try him. The guy was diagnosed with Asperger's.
Yeah.
Which is a form of autism.
Yeah.
People with Asperger's syndrome, they have a tendency to focus in on, mm-hmm, one thing,
yeah,
and that's all they think about, is finding out all they can about this, mm-hmm, one thing.
Yeah, and I think, you know, one of the ironic things is, you know, as I said, he does have this Asperger's diagnosis, which, you know, people, it's like you point to make a very good point, that it's sort of like an offshoot of autism. A lot of people with autism, you know, they do find it difficult to function in the, I won't say the normal world, you know, there's nothing probably normal about our world, but in the, you know, the conventional sense, but they exhibit brilliant skills in other areas. For example, you find some autistic people who, you know, they're just sort of masterful musicians or artists. You know, they can learn like an entire symphony by listening to it once. They can play it on the piano. So their brains are sort of, nothing wrong with the brain, they're just wired in a different way, and I think that, mm-hmm, applies to McKinnon. So. And I think also, you know, this issue of, you know, bringing him over and trying him over here, the biggest stumbling block to doing that isn't whether or not it could be successfully achieved, or, you know, it couldn't, is it's just giving so much publicity to it. You know, that's one of the ironic things that I think the governments of both the UK and the US don't want, or kind of niggly about, is the fact that McKinnon has so much publicity, but he only has so much publicity because it's rumbled on for so long. You know, I'm quite sure had the US government or the UK government put the fear of God into him and said, Gary, you know, we're going to give you a 12-month suspended sentence, if you even go near a computer, we'll jail you for 50 years, he would never have done anything else since. But it's, yeah, the very fact of not taking that approach and just wanting to throw the book at him, so to speak, one way or another, has meant it's rumbled on so long, and the longer it goes on, the more and more publicity it gets, and more people learn about this secret space program and these pictures, and, you know, it's probably had the opposite effect that the government really wants.
Yeah, I agree. And I always wondered that you know, the his attorney, mm, had come up with an idea, maybe, you know, having him claimed incompetent to stand trial.
Well, I mean, that has been put forward, that he isn't, you know, I won't say competent, because that sounds like, he's mentally deranged or something. He isn't. You know, he's a lucid, very clever, intelligent man who probably as a result of his condition, you know, went full bore after this one thing and by hook or by crook was going to find the answer. So certainly, you know, this is one of the issues that's been put forward, is his mental capacity to stand trial. And, you know, that is one of the reasons why it has gone on so long, is because, you know, medical people have been brought in to evaluate it, and that takes time, you know, and then that information has to be passed to the prosecution team and the defense team, etc., etc. And so, you know, and time passes by, and before you know it, 3 months have gone and 6 months have gone, and then another loophole comes along. And, you know, it's a highly complex situation, you know, that everybody, whether the prosecution, the defense, McKinnon, the US government, the UK government, it's, you know, it really is a weird can of worms with so many strands and legal issues to it that, you know, I suspect that's one of the reasons why, it's not been cleared up overnight, if you like.
This is true. Oh, let's see. I brought up the wrong window here. I need my window with questions on it. Okay, this is a question from Avenger, and he asks, what do you think... do you think that advanced, perhaps back-engineered, U.S. craft are being test-flown out of Fort Worth?
Out of Fort Worth? Well, I actually live in spitting distance of Fort Worth. I live in Arlington, which is sort of just between Dallas and Fort Worth. I honestly don't know anything about that. But what I would say, I think enough people have come forward to suggest that whether we have back-engineered alien technology, or we ourselves have developed highly advanced technologies that aren't in the public domain, I don't think there's any doubt about that at all. I think, you know, there's enough whistleblower testimony, on-the-record testimony, to suggest that even though, you know, the world is still being run on oil, it doesn't have to be. And I think one of the reasons it is purely because of the power structure. You know, there are a lot of people in positions of influence and powerful people who have a lot to lose if oil is replaced by something else. And I think there is enough evidence to suggest that something else, whatever it may be, exists, but it's in the hands of a very small elite who will not release it until such a point as, you know, the economy is going to collapse, because we're at that, you know, when we do reach that point, when there is no more oil, then they'll release it and charge us a fortune for using it, you know, okay, just to maintain the status quo. But I truthfully don't, I haven't heard that's the Fort Worth story at all, unfortunately. I should look into it if I'm just living down the road from it.
This is the first I'd heard of it myself. Another question here from our virtual auditorium. This one's from Skymon, and Skymon says, Nick, can you tell us about the guy you met who said he worked at Area 51?
Oh, yeah, this is a really weird sort of very strange sort of Hall of Mirrors story. You know, I mentioned at the beginning how, you know, you write books or articles and people approach you to tell their stories. And this actually happened with a guy, very elderly guy now. I think he's like 80, probably 86, 87, at least mid-80s, something like that, named John. And he told me a very fascinating story that linked NASA and Area 51 going way back to like 1970, 71. And prior to this time, he'd served in the U.S. Police Department, in the New York Police Department. And he had actually been involved in one specific incident where the police had been involved in a case that spilled over into a Russian espionage case in which the FBI were involved. And he played kind of a significant role from the police perspective, and actually people in the FBI and the intelligence community that were involved were very impressed by the role he played. And then when he was due to come up for retirement from the police, somebody from the intelligence community made sort of like a cloak and dagger approach to him and said something along the lines of, you know, you impressed a lot of people with your work in the police on this, you know, sort of joint FBI police program. Are you interested in getting further involved, you know, in the intelligence world, or do you just want to go into retirement? And he said, well, no, you know, this sounds interesting. You know, they sort of outlined for him, you know, the interest in getting, like, private security at some of the, you know, classified installations, that sort of thing. A lot of people don't know that, you know, places like Area 51 and military bases, the security actually isn't done by, you know, the soldiers. You know, it's like, for example, Area 51 isn't policed by members of the U.S. Army. You know, it's not like there's the 45th Infantry of whatever group manning the base. It's actually contracted out to private companies like Wackenhut. And Wackenhut was a company that John went to work for. And they're like a private security company that, you know, offer government agencies perimeter protection, data protection, all that sort of thing. And he was offered a job working as a custodian of files in one particular office at Area 51. And he said that a lot of the files that he had custody over dealt with UFOs and also NASA's involvement in classified UFO projects that were being undertaken at Area 51. And he said that basically he was given a briefing on sort of the work he would have to do. And it was almost like, as I said, an archivist, like a custodian of files that regularly, the files would be pulled out by employees of Area 51 that needed to review this material for part of their work on ongoing classified UFO programs. And John said a lot of these files went back to the 40s and talked about UFO crashes in the 40s, autopsies of alien bodies, and programs right through, bear in mind this was the early 70s he worked there, right through to the late 60s, where NASA had involvement in things like analyzing autopsy reports and being involved in sort of biological studies and DNA studies of alien bodies and, you know, body parts and that sort of thing. And he said, you know, as I said, he got a briefing and his job was to, you know, sign people in and sign them out and ensure that all files that were taken out were brought back, etc. And the weird thing was he was actually only offered this position for a year, after which he got into even more lucrative work within the intelligence community. And he said that he always wondered if the files were real, or they were fake, or they were partly real, and were they real files, or was it done to sort of test his loyalty, expose him to fake stuff and see if he talked out of turn, or, because he didn't actually see any UFOs or aliens himself, he just saw these files. And it is sort of a really strange story where you realize how possibly, although we know there's a genuine UFO phenomenon, is it possible that the intelligence community has manipulated it over time? You know, so we don't know if we're being exposed to real material, fake material, or a combination of the two. And I suspect it's the latter, and maybe that was what was done with John. But he was shown files that told part of a real story. Maybe part of it was a bogus story, purely and simply because if he then went out and spoke about it, it would actually confuse the real story even more, which I think is what the government wants. The government knows it can't hide the fact that UFOs exist and there's been a cover-up, so because they can't hide it, they try and confuse it and have us all chasing our tails in different directions. And John actually speculated that that might have been what was done with him. It was a case of, let's feed this guy some interesting real stuff, but let's mix it up with some fake stuff, and then when he puts it out there, it'll then discredit the real stuff, you know. So it's a really complex can of worms from a psychological perspective. And one of the ironies is you have to almost, you know, give it to the guys who come up with these scenarios that, unfortunately, they're very clever at what they do. And that's why I think we have been running around chasing our tails. But the upshot was, as it relates to NASA, as I said, that John was talking about classified NASA programs at Area 51 where they were sort of looking at alien technology, alien biology, and trying to understand it and replicate the technology even as well for the space program.
You know, a comment made in our virtual auditorium here saying that oh,
what was that?
That was a little loud. that all of this UFO that was collected was stored there at Area 51, and it seems logical to me that this would provide legitimate denial coverage to NASA, the Air Force, and other agencies when they denied doing UFO research or having info.
Yeah, I think, you know, I mean, when it comes to things like Area 51 and government involvement, back engineering, alien technology, you know, we're still scrambling around to a degree to find out what the truth is. And I think one of the important things is that a lot of people don't necessarily realize or appreciate is that, you know, government agencies don't just hide things from the general public and the media. They actually hide things from each other as well. You know, it's like Agency A doesn't always like sharing with Agency B what they know. You know, for example, let's say, hypothetically, there's somebody working on a UFO program at Area 51, and he's found to be a, you know, like a double agent working for the Chinese, leaking information out to the Chinese. Well, Area 51 then goes into lockdown, and, you know, let's say the CIA, they find a Chinese mole in their organization. Area 51 then thinks, well, you know, that guy we found has got to be linked with a CIA guy. Let's put ourselves on lockdown from the CIA. You know, that in simple terms, that's very putting it very simply, but that's what happens, you know, is that if there's a breach of security in one area, another agency, you know, is fearful of sharing their information with that agency or that with that body. So, in other words, you know, whatever's going on at Area 51 and how it ties in with NASA or other agencies, you know, the material is very often highly compartmentalized where, you know, it's hidden. You're only told what you need to know to do your part of the job. You know, it's like you don't join the CIA and you're automatically told what happened at Roswell. You know, that would just be too simplistic. You're told all you need to know to do your job. That's how secrets are kept. And I think that applies specifically to the UFO subject. I think, you know, the idea that there are hundreds of thousands of people in governments, like the CIA, the NSA, the DIA, whoever, all in on this big secret. I don't think they are. I think it's a select few in each group. You know, the irony is there are probably high-ranking people in the CIA, you know, sitting around having a drink in a bar after work saying, I wonder what really happened at Roswell, you know, because they're not in the loop. And, you know, I think the number of people who are in the loop is probably a very small select body. And as I said, that is the way secrets are kept. You know, you don't tell everybody and his brother what's going on. If they work with you.
It's like when you've got a piece of alien technology, okay? You don't just tout it to all the, show it to all the whole bunch of people. No, you go and find somebody who's real sharp, and if it's like some electronic device, you know, somebody who's top in their field in electronics.
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the ironies is, you know, you have people like, say, for example, like in Iraq now, if you've got somebody whose job it is to decipher and interpret, you know, let's say an Iraqi code or something like that, that person may not be of the highest rank, but if they're someone who can really apply themselves to code breaking, they could. The irony is they could have a lower rank than somebody three ranks above them, but because of the classified nature of the work they're doing, they're exposed to far more secret data than the person above them. You know, people don't realize that it's the illogical aspect of that, but that is often how it works. Your rank doesn't necessarily relate to what you're cleared to see. You know, it's the work that you're able to do that, you know, offers you the opportunity to be exposed to this or exposed to that. And you may be, as I said, at a lower level than someone else, but have a higher clearance in one specific area of your work.
Well, and then, you know, they have all this compartmentation.
Yeah.
You know, they just give the people just what they need to know to do their work, and that's it.
And I think that's why it's been so difficult for those of us in the UFO community to solve the puzzle, because I said the number of people who really know the dark, deep, guarded secrets is so small. But that's why I think the secret's been so successfully withheld. If there are hundreds of thousands of people knowing, something substantial beyond what we already have, which is substantial, would have come out. I think the only way that they've successfully managed to hide pretty much all the hard evidence and stuff that's undeniable is because it's actually a very small number of people who are hiding it, not a massive number of people.
We're getting short on time here, and there's still so much to cover.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to bring up your radio program, Exploring All Realms, on Thursday evenings, and with your co-host, Raven, I hope I get this right.
Mindell.
Mindell?
Yeah. Yeah, well, I do a lot of radio shows where I'm the guest, but I also co-host one where I interview the guests, or we go interview the guests, me and a friend of mine, Raven Mindell, and it's called Exploring All Realms. And we look at different mysteries like we're doing tonight, whether it's UFOs, you know, whether it's ghosts, cryptozoology, that's one of my other big interests, you know, like Bigfoot, the Loch Ness Monster, that sort of thing. And as I said, the show is called Exploring All Realms. And if people want to find it, they can find it on the web at apxn.com. And we try and sort of mix it up each week and have, you know, varying different guests. We've had, for example, Linda Godfrey, who's written books about werewolves. We've had Brad Steiger, all sorts of, you know, famous authors, and you know, we try and each week sort of vary it so people have different things to think about and talk about, etc.
Oh gosh, you know, I'm gonna have to tune into that. I UFOs is my number one passion, mm-hmm. but I'm into all kinds of stuff. Yeah. Ghost hunting, cryptozoology. All things 14, okay?
Well, as I said, it's Exploring All Realms, and it's apxn.com.
It'd be great. I'll have to check that out. What time does it air?
That's a good point. 8 o'clock till 9 o'clock Central.
Central. Oh, 8. I'm going to have to write that down so I don't forget it.
On Thursday nights.
8 to 9 Central.
Yeah.
8 to 9. Okay, got it written down. If I don't write it down, I will forget it.
Yeah, I'm like that.
Oh, gosh. And you were telling me during the break that you have another book coming out, mid-June?
Yeah, it comes out roughly about June 14th or 15th. It's called The Real Men in Black, and it's a study, full-length study of the whole Men in Black mystery. Excuse me, going back to the 40s to the present day and looking at the different theories. You know, a lot of people just consider the Men in Black government agents, but then there's a lot of weirder reports, you know, strange and far ominous, sinister Men in Black that some people, you know, suggested have alien origins. Others talk about supernatural origins, occult origins. Some people suggest they're time travelers. So what I've tried to do in the book is look at, you know, go back and put a new sort of slant on a lot of the older cases. Present a huge number of new cases, which surprised me, the extent to which Men in Black reports are still being made, and also look at the main researchers in the field who've commented on this to, you know, present their theories as to whether they're government people, aliens, paranormal, time travelers, or is it a combination of a whole range of things. So that should be out in about 3 months, something like that, 2.5 months maybe.
I'm looking forward to that one. That one looks so interesting. Like I was saying during break, you don't hear much about Men in Black anymore.
Yeah. Well, the funny thing is... Oh, go on, sorry.
Oh, I was just going to say, and then I don't think I've ever even heard of a book that was just on Men in Black.
Yeah, well, they're sort of few and far between, but, I mean, there have been some good ones. There was a good one written back in the 50s called They Knew Too Much About Flying Saucers by a man named Gray Barker. But the funny thing, when you get the book, you'll see, is that on all my books, you know, the author, obviously, they want a head and shoulders picture of the author. And for this one, they got me a photograph taken of me wearing a black 1950s sort of gumshoe detective hat and black sunglasses. So I look like a definitive Man in Black on the back cover. So. which I should hasten to add, I'm not a Man in Black, but I look like one on the back cover. So. I do dress in black most of the time, but not a literal Man in Black. So.
Oh, not the classic with the old-style fedora and the black
suit. That's what they've got me wearing on the back cover, a fedora and black sunglasses and a black jacket and black T-shirt. And
oh, my. Oh, gosh, it makes me think of an episode of X-Files with Jesse Ventura the guy from Jeopardy, Alex Trebek.
Yeah, and of course, I'm kind of pale and skinny. And so I look even more like one of these sinister-looking Men in Black as well. So.
Oh, gosh. It gives me a chuckle.
People are probably going to look at me in a different light.
Oh, well, you know, you have done, you know, I mean, you're a very prolific writer.
Mm.
You've done, gosh, I don't know how many different documentaries from Chupacabra to UFOs to whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You keep really busy at this, don't you?
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, I have a lot of interest in different areas, whether, like you said, the Chupacabra, UFOs, Bigfoot. Cryptozoology and UFOs are my two main areas of interest. You know, I don't get involved in much along the lines of ghost hunting, mainly because, you know, it's not an area I've delved into to a great extent, and a lot of other people done, you know, very good work in that area, and I don't see, you know, there's no point in me sort of stumbling in and bumbling around, you know, trying to do what people have done for years. But, you know, for me at least, the biggest thing why, you know, I write the books and do the TV is to get information out to people. I think that's the most important thing of all. Is, you know, it's like with the, whether it's you with your radio show, me writing books, somebody else doing magazine articles, somebody else doing a podcast, you know, whatever. The more we can get information out and share it, the bigger chance we have of solving some of these mysteries. You know, the worst thing we can do is sort of file it all away in a filing cabinet and say, oh no, this is my story and, you know, I'm not sharing it. You do get that from time to time, which I've never really understood. I think, you know, if we find stuff, let's put it out there because everybody's interested. And, you know, I always say to people, it doesn't matter how many books I write, you know, the most important people in the subject are the witnesses, the eyewitnesses, because without the people coming to us and being willing to share their stories and have their stories told, we've got nothing. You know, so I think whether it's the witnesses, writers, TV producers, radio hosts, whatever, collectively, we need to put this out and then, you know, share it, and we'll have a better chance of resolving what's going on.
I have a question here that I got to ask from a virtual auditorium. This is from Skymon. And Skymon asks, how did Nick get such an interesting accent? I don't know if it's Australian or British.
It's British. Some people ask me if I'm Irish, South African, Australian, English, New Zealand, Canadian. But no, I'm English. But I was born in England, grew up in central England, about 20 miles from a city called Birmingham. Birmingham's about 120 miles north of London. I was about 20 miles north of Birmingham. And it's sort of like a cross between a, you know, sort of very forested countryside area and, you know, I said only 20 miles from a big city of about 7 million people. So you sort of had the best of both worlds. But I moved to the US about 10 years ago. I lived just outside Dallas, Texas. My wife's originally from Texas, but she grew up in, she actually was born in Texas. She's a US citizen, but she grew up in the Cayman Islands and didn't move back to the US until, I think, her early 20s. And then we met and did the whole thing, coming back and forth to each other's countries, and then, you know, I did the whole immigration thing, etc., and officially and legally moved over here, and instead of being over about 10 years, but I guess I never lost the accent, so.
Oh, well, I keep waiting for you to pick up that
Texan drawl.
Southern drawl with the British accent on the side.
I think that's sort of, if that was going to happen after 10 years, it probably would have happened, and no, I sort of see a lot of people in cowboy hats and boots, and there's me in sort of black T-shirt and black jeans and, you know, scowling around.
I was just wondering, what was it that got you, was there any special event or something that inspired you to go into 14 subjects?
Well, yeah, it was a couple of things, really. One was that when I was about 6 years old, I settled, grew up in England. I was only about six at the time. My mum and dad took me on a week's holiday to Scotland. And we spent one day at Loch Ness. And, you know, when you're sort of 6 years old, I mean, my dad told me the story of the Loch Ness Monster. And, you know, at 6 years old, you kind of equate it, I suppose, with stories of, like, monsters in the wardrobe or under the bed. You know, it's sort of like a spooky tale. And even though, you know, I said I was only six, I still have a couple of very fragmentary memories of standing on the shore of this huge loch, which is, people don't realize how big Loch Ness is, like 23 miles long and a mile wide, about 800 feet deep. such a huge body of water, but I still have about three or four vague memories of standing on the lock shore with my dad telling me this story. And then when I got to about 13, 14, you know, I began reading more about UFOs and Bigfoot and lake monsters. And my dad actually served in the British Royal Air Force and actually worked on radar and was involved in a couple of weird UFO incidents. And so all of this sort of collectively got me interested. And then when I finished school, I began working on a rock music magazine back in England called Zero, and did that for a few years. And I still do a lot of that now. I mean, you know, although I write books, you know, I sort of have a journalism right across the board. So, you know, rock music's one of my big interests. You know, that's sort of what got me interested in writing. And I worked on this magazine, Zero, for a couple of years. And that gave me sort of a full background and teaching, if you like, and tutoring in journalism. And then I thought, well, why not try and combine the background in journalism with the interest I'd sort of developed in UFOs, cryptozoology, things like that, and, you know, have a go at combining the two and investigate things of a weird nature but apply journalistic tools to doing it. And so that's what I've hopefully done. As I've tried to do, you know, and you can only, obviously with things like this, you know, you have to think out of the box a little bit, but I always try and apply regular journalist tools, even if it's like an irregular story, if you like.
Mm. We've got time for one more question.
Okay.
This one's from David, and he says, I know you have researched and written about many cryptozoology creatures.
Mm.
Are there any that stand out to you as being more plausible and possible than others?
Yeah, probably one more than any other is a creature known as Orang Pendek. Orang Pendek is a creature that's been reported on Sumatra, on the island of Sumatra. And basically, you know, people talk about sort of like unknown apes, you know, man beasts. People talk about Bigfoot, the Yeti, Abominable Snowman, that sort of thing, Sasquatch. But there have been other reports. Orang Pendek is described as like an ape man on the island of Sumatra, but it's described as being small in size, like 3 to 4 foot in height, so looking like a small ape, if you like, but with very human-like traits and characteristics. You know, possibly uses tools, weapons, like, you know, clubs, that sort of thing. It could even have a high degree of intelligence, but looks like a very primitive ape man, you know, like a cross between a Neanderthal man and a human, or possibly even more primitive looking than a Neanderthal, but of a much smaller size, you know, like 3 to 4 feet. And there have been a lot of highly credible reports made of this creature, Orang Pendek, over the years, seen by zoologists, qualified scientists even, and a number of expeditions have been launched looking for the Orang Pendek. And there's even a friend of mine, Richard Freeman, and another friend of mine, excuse me, Adam Davis, they're going on another expedition. They've already been on several. They're going on another expedition this year to look for Orang Pendek for a couple of weeks. And I actually don't doubt that at some point in the very near future, we probably will find evidence for Orang Pendek. And if it is some sort of primitive offshoot of the human race that survived, you know, extinction from however long ago, it's going to be sort of a profound scientific discovery. So I think Orang Pendek is one of the more credible ones, and I also think, more importantly, it's one of the ones we're going to resolve in the near future.
Well, fantastic. Obviously, we've got about 4 minutes or so left. Is there anything you'd like to say to our listeners?
Well, you know, I always tell people, you know, I think, as I said earlier, probably the most important thing or aspect of, the, you know, whether we're talking about UFOs, cryptozoology, any paranormal thing, the most important thing are the witnesses. And, you know, I always encourage people, if they're comfortable, about speaking out, you know, or at least confiding in people, you know, such as myself in the research community, because, you know, I do understand people have concerns about being quoted if they don't want to be quoted. You know, and I always stress to people, you know, if somebody tells me a story, I never, ever use anybody's story unless they give written permission for me to do so. You know, I think, you know, personal privacy is paramount when you're dealing with controversial issues. But I always encourage people, if they're willing to relate their stories, because I think the more information we have, the more we can share it, the more chance we have of resolving what's going on. And so, you know, that's one of the things I always say to people. You know, if you're comfortable with speaking, you know, you're doing us all a service, because you're the most important people. You're the ones who've seen things. And I think, you know, without those people, we have no radio shows, you have no books, you have no magazines, we have nothing. You know, so I always encourage people, if you want to come forward, you know, don't worry, there are people who are going to take your story seriously and listen to it, you know, in a proper, right fashion, if you like.
Oh, I agree with that wholeheartedly. You know, if it wasn't for witnesses, we wouldn't be talking.
Nope, we would be watching American Idol right now or something.
Oh, God forbid.
I'll give you a confess something, me and my wife watch American Idol.
Oh, well, okay. My husband says, yeah, you have to admit, Steven Tyler has made it interesting. Oh, well. Anyway, let's see. Your book, The NASA Conspiracies, and your upcoming book about Men in Black.
Mm-hmm.
The Men in Black will be out mid-June, and where will everybody be able to go to find these books?
Well, all hopefully good outlets, Borders, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, you know, anywhere that sells books, you should be able to get them. You know, they're all have like an on-shelf presence, if you like, and if they're not in stock, you know, they should be able to order them for you anyway. So.
And I have to say, I'm very pleased that Borders actually separates the ufology book from the witchcraft and ghost stories and mm-hmm. and fake psychics and mm-hmm. you know, like,
yeah, so you're right, some bookshops don't do that. They have like what they call the New Age section, and it's like five
exactly.
or six shelves, and everything's just lumped in. They just it's almost like they just throw, you know, a book comes out on Bigfoot, one comes out on Ouija boards, and they just throw them all on the shelves together, and you've got to wade your way through them to find the one you want. So.
Yeah, I mean, it makes it so much easier because it's all only comprises like a couple of shelves, you know, they're wide
yeah.
shelves, but, you know, a couple of shelves. You don't have to go digging through
yeah.
books on astrology and all
yeah.
this stuff to find the UFO-related books.
Yeah, surely it doesn't take long to put it in alphabetical order and just separate it, but apparently it does. So.
Yeah, but very few bookstores do that, which
yeah.
drives me crazy.
I actually always, whenever I go in a bookshop, I say in mine, I always rearrange the shelves. I put mine at the front with a face pointed outwards. So I probably shouldn't say that, because the bookshops will now go back and rearrange it so that you're never able to see them again. So.
Well, I'm kind of guilty of something similar. I see a book in there that doesn't belong in there, and I'll just take it and stick it in there someplace else. Okay. Unfortunately, though, we're all out of time, Nick, and I appreciate you coming on tonight. I thoroughly enjoyed this.
Well, thanks, dear. I had a good time. Thank you. And we got a lot of interesting questions from the chat room as well. So.
Oh, yes, we do. We usually do. These guys are a smart group. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for tonight. I'd like to thank everyone for tuning in, and also thank all of those who joined us here in the Pal Talk Auditorium. Thanks, you've been a great bunch tonight. Stay tuned for Voice of the People, hosted by Greg Miller. And I need to let people know that I will be taking a hiatus from doing my program to recover from an upcoming surgery I have scheduled next week. I'm not sure how long I will be gone, but they will be reruns played in my absence. And so everybody take care and be cool and keep up the, you know, keep listening to the network. And until then, remember, keep an eye to the sky. And good night, everyone.